Groupthink Part 3, A Dangerous Sense of Invulnerability. The first characteristic of groupthink is a sense of invulnerability. The group thinks it cannot be brought down. This is an incredibly dangerous mindset. Ancient Asian generals and strategists conceptualized the proper mindset for going to war. They knew that invulnerability was an ideal, not a reality. Their theories have stood the test of time over thousands of years. Three rules govern the mindset of the general at war. 1, you can be defeated by anybody if you make enough mistakes. 2, the war is never over. It will simply rise and fall. 3, impetuous courage on your part puts you under the enemy's control. First, fight groupthink. Never claim either victory or defeat. The general must never be deterred from these realities of war. First of all, weaker forces can defeat stronger forces. Scattered enemies who witlessly run away, if they are cornered, will regroup and fight with a desperation that equals the greatest valor of the most valiant warrior. The great general Sun Tzu advised his commanders to always make a way of escape for the enemy. That way, the enemy soldiers could be cut down gradually as they fled, and as long as they could see a way ahead, they might never have the sense to try to make a stand. But if an army in retreat is cornered, the nearness of death would make the routed soldiers regroup and fight as they had not yet fought and cost many lives of the general's own army. One of the greatest mistakes fundamentalism has made was in its self-assurances that it could not be brought down. That was groupthink in all its stupid glory. Fundamentalism is still trying to prop itself up on its shaky legs. The people who have suffered at the hands of corrupt fundamentalism have truly done it far more damage than its leaders ever counted on suffering. They thought they were invulnerable. But let no former victims make the same mistake as his or her abusers. It is possible to lose in court against an abusive clergyman, deacon, or parent. It is possible to lose in the media. It is possible to lose money and dignity to the bad guys. It is possible to make such catastrophic mistakes and to act from blind self-assurance that you hand victory to the other side. At the moment, in my opinion, fundamentalism is trying to bear up and regroup under the new exposure it's getting for its sins and crimes. But war waxes and wanes. Eventually, if they cannot recast themselves in a more favorable light, fundamentalist leaders will become desperate and will go on the offensive far more aggressively than they have yet done. Certainly, more so now than in the past, fundamentalism has started to exercise more care in how it meets the challenges that it faces. Will it adapt quickly enough to regain the ground it's lost? Overall, I think it will not, but events will have to prove out its fate. Still, anybody who fights a war should heed the warning of fundamentalism. Carelessness and a sense of invulnerability can bring down any army, great or small. There really is no strength in numbers. There is strength in wisdom. Next, the war is never over. The perfect way to get ambushed is to tell yourself that you've won the war. That's what the Indians let Custer think at Little Bighorn, and he fell into their trap. He was certain that they were inferior as human beings to his men. He was certain that he had superior weapons. He was certain that he was a better military leader. He also thought God was on his side. Fighting the Indians at that point was, to him, more sport than war. He thought there were 800 Indians for his men to slaughter, and he thought he would be waking them up from sleep when he attacked. Really, Custer wasn't even thinking of Little Bighorn as a real war. He thought he'd already won. He was planning a slaughter, and that was what he got, but not quite what he intended. Nobody warned Custer. Nobody cautioned Custer. Nobody went behind him to recheck the Indian agents who had given him only half the story because he'd only asked for half the story. And this was because groupthink was at work. Whites were supposed to be smarter than Indians. Whites were supposed to be better than Indians. God was supposed to be giving the American West to the whites. Even battle-wise and experienced commanders did not treat the Lakota and Cheyenne enemies with the respect they knew that these Indian fighters merited. Custer worked on an assumption that he was simply cleaning out some rebellious Indians who wouldn't move when they were told to move. He had no idea that they were massing for a tremendous war that would be their last stand if necessary. Their war certainly had not ended. And my guess is that Custer realized this right at the end, perhaps the last conclusion he ever reached. Recognizing that a war is never over means that people have to do two things. Pick their battles in order to gain the most ground, and develop a strategy that leads to victories in the straightest, shortest, simplest lines. Anybody who decides to massacre every single soldier who wears the enemy's livery will end up defeated. Anybody who responds to every bait thrown by the enemy will fall into quicksand because the enemy will lead him into traps. Battle requires a focused mindset, self-discipline, and the ability to wait. Groupthink lacks all of these things. Finally, groupthink is often guilty of impetuous courage. Hitotsu, keki no yu wa mishimuru koto. That was the fifth point of the Dojo Kun that I learned as a teenager. It translates as, one, to guard against impetuous courage. Even the reciting of the Dojo Kun does not translate perfectly to Westerners, for it is partly a pledge and partly a creed and partly an acknowledgement of human frailty. As a student of Shotokan karate, I was expected to refrain from impetuous courage. I also promised to train myself to refrain from impetuous courage. And yet, students of karate shout the creed to assert it. In other words, it's true whether or not I follow it. Sensei Funakoshi knew all about impetuous courage, and he had seen his share of groupthink as a gentle Okinawan scholar teaching karate in bigoted Japanese society where many looked down upon him because he was merely Okinawan. For groupthink gives birth to this folly of impetuous courage. First, it is, at its simplest, violent action. More precisely, it is overreaction. Yet it is also too much self-assurance in conflict, which can lead to overaggression when peaceful dialogue would solve a problem. Truly, punching out somebody for calling me a name is an example of impetuous courage, but so is striding boldly into a room full of thugs simply because I am sure I can handle myself. In groupthink, members of a group convince themselves that their group is smart enough, right enough, fit enough, tough enough to handle anything that comes, and so they take on battles that they cannot win. Remember Jason Jantz and that completely stupid controversy he caused over end of the spear? That was impetuous courage. Or Jerry Falwell making his ridiculous declaration that 9/11 was the fault of the gays? That was impetuous courage. A group that is guilty of groupthink will go out and make mountains out of molehills in order to stir up controversy and cause a fight. That is impetuous courage. Any group that does that one time too many, or one time against an adversary that is truly dangerous and won't back down, will destroy itself.